Welcome to Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower. Our guest today is Nicholas Miller, who is an associate professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. His research focuses on nuclear proliferation and international security broadly, which are definitely two questions we're going to ask him quite a bit about. But before I do that, I want to thank you, Nick, so much for joining us. It is really a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks. That's great to be here.
So I think let me take it away with the first question, and Nick. We are approaching the one-year anniversary of Russia's renewed invasion of Ukraine. And when the invasion happened, and subsequently, many feared that we would see nuclear proliferation cascades, since the war showed that nuclear weapons can serve as a shield to enable conventional conquest, and that it's really a dangerous world to be in if you are a non-nuclear weapon state, if you either never had the bomb or you gave it up. Now, if you reflect on the past year, what's your balance sheet in terms of the proliferation implications of the war in Ukraine? Were those fears of proliferation cascades really entirely misplaced, or what's your take here?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say about this is kind of a caveat. 1 year is obviously a really short time frame, especially when we're talking about nuclear proliferation, which tends to unfold over pretty long timelines. So we should at least be open to the idea there could be longer term implications that we haven't seen yet. Having said all of that, I would say so far there's very little evidence at all that the war has, you know, stimulated nuclear proliferation in terms of like a new country seeking nuclear weapons or even the acceleration of an existing nuclear program. We don't have like new entrants to the nuclear proliferation landscape that we know about, at least. If you think about the countries that are generally considered, you know, the serious candidates for proliferation, most of them are actually American allies or partners. You know, countries like Japan, Taiwan, maybe Germany, Saudi Arabia. I mean, the indication so far with these countries is that they want to rely on closer ties with Washington to deal with their security anxieties, which might have been increased by the war in Ukraine. And there's not really any indication these countries want to go off on some sort of independent nuclear path. And I think you could even make the case that if the U.S. responds by strengthening its alliance commitments, it's actually possible that the war in Ukraine could end up making proliferation less likely in the long run, right? If it results in stronger alliance commitments. There is one, you know, potential counterexample we should probably talk about, which is South Korea, right? And some people might have seen this in the news in the last few weeks, where you had the South Korean president stating that they should at least think about the possibility of developing nuclear weapons to deal with, you know, the threat from North Korea. This is something they had, you know, worked on back in the 1970s, but then shut it down in the face of U.S. pressure. I would say, though, that that is not, you know, great evidence in favor of the argument of the war in Ukraine stimulating proliferation for a couple reasons. One would be the interest of, you know, the South Korean president Yoon in nuclear weapons predates the war in Ukraine, right? And he's been talking about this for a long time. And there's not really any evidence it's directly tied to what's happening in Ukraine, right? It's more about, you know, as I mentioned, what's going on in North Korea. And also, if you followed the news closely, you saw that, you know, very quickly he walked these comments back, right? And he said, no, South Korea remains committed to the NPT. We're going to rely on U.S. extended deterrence for protection. So even though you kind of see these headlines, I don't think it's, you know, evidence of kind of material changes in South Korea's policy. I'd say the one case where you could maybe say the war in Ukraine has made proliferation more likely is Iran, but it's not actually for the reasons that like the conventional wisdom suggests that you talked about in your question, right? It's not that Iran has suddenly decided, hey, we're going to do what Russia did and get nuclear weapons and then launch a war of conquest, right? Or it's not that they suddenly are like, we need to avoid getting attacked and being the next Ukraine. Instead, it seems to be more about, you know, the geopolitics of the relationships between Russia, Iran, and the United States. So, you know, right when the war started last year, that was when there were still active negotiations about reviving the JCPOA, the Iran deal, and Russia kind of threw a wrench into those talks as part of kind of their, you know, way of pushing back against the West that was supporting Ukraine. And then as the war has unfolded, you know, as everyone has probably seen in the news, Iran has kind of very clearly thrown its lot in with Russia, right? They've been supplying them with drones that they're using against Ukraine. And I think this makes it much more difficult politically to kind of imagine that we're going to see the JCPOA revive, right? Or any nuclear deal struck between Iran and the US or, you know, the European powers, right? It's hard enough to get anyone in the US to support a deal with Iran. It's a lot harder when they're, you know, helping to kill Ukrainians. And so that makes me worry that the prospects for diplomacy there are pretty bleak. And so it could end up that the war in Ukraine makes, you know, an Iranian bomb more likely, right? But again, it's interesting to note that's not really the argument that most people are making about how Ukraine is supposed to be affecting proliferation. So overall, I'd say not nearly as much evidence as you might expect if you've been reading these sort of more alarmist takes.
That's great. Just a quick follow-up question, Nick. So if the war in Ukraine, for counterintuitive reasons, might make an Iranian bomb more likely, or at least mitigate against the restoration of the JCPOA, should that not have us be concerned about further proliferation in the Middle East? Like, what about the Saudis, for instance?
Yeah, I do think that's something to worry about. Saudi Arabia has been very clear for a long time, if you take them at their word, right, that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, you know, they might be forced to do the same thing, right? And there are some indicators that they've been, you know, taking steps towards developing a nuclear program, right? And there was evidence of, you know, uranium mining that was taking place in Saudi Arabia. You know, they've announced plans for a large nuclear energy program, right? They're soliciting, you know, bids and trying to figure out who's going to be building their first nuclear power plants. And so it's possible that, you know, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia would at least move towards kind of a hedging posture. I'm not, you know, convinced that they would sprint for a nuclear weapon, right? In part because they'd have to worry about what the implications of that decision would be, right? In terms of their relationship with the United States, right? Which is obviously, you know, probably their most important bilateral relationship. But I do think it would at the very least lead them to kind of move towards kind of latency hedging posture.
Nick, this is so interesting. You've been talking a lot about sort of the drivers and inhibitors for proliferation on the side of potential proliferators, but I'm hoping we can kind of switch gears and talk a little bit about the discourse around the potential for proliferation. A lot of your academic work has focused on this issue of what drives proliferation from an historical perspective. And I'm curious to hear if there are sort of parallels between, you know, what we're hearing now and what we saw in the past with respect to this discourse about the potential for proliferation cascades and these kind of dire predictions that might feed into some kind of proliferation panic at these various inflection points. So what are you, can you compare and contrast kind of what we've seen previously in the historical record and maybe some of what we're seeing now?
Yeah, I mean, these sort of predictions of, you know, cascades, tipping points, dominoes, there's all these different terms people throw around. They've been around pretty much since the beginning of the nuclear age, right? Although they've kind of ebbed and flowed, I guess, in how prevalent they are. I would say they were particularly prevalent and kind of influential, according to the research I've done, in the kind of first half of the 1960s, and then also kind of later on in the 1970s. What's interesting is, you know, the triggers for these, you know, panics, if you want to call them that, were quite different from what we're seeing today. Right. So in the case of the 60s and 70s, the main triggers were the entrance of new countries into the nuclear club, right? China getting nuclear weapons in 1964, India in 1974, and the worry that that was going to kind of lead to copycats, right? Or lots of other countries going down the nuclear road, right? And that's not what we're talking about today. We're not talking about a new country getting nuclear weapons. We're talking about how countries react to observing a non-nuclear state getting attacked by a nuclear state. So that's an important difference. But let me just say a little bit more about kind of these earlier episodes and talk about maybe whether those sort of proliferation panics were kind of more, you know, more plausible or kind of rational than the ones that we're seeing today. I mean, if you go back to the 1960s, the early 1960s, the Cold War was at its height, right? Maybe its tensest moment, right? You have the Cuban Missile Crisis, you have, you know, the second Berlin crisis. Lots of countries have very understandable security anxieties and potential reasons to want nuclear weapons. You also have nuclear technology becoming a lot more available for the first time. in part because of the Atoms for Peace program that the US launched and the Soviet kind of program that was launched in response to that. You also had all these advances in nuclear technology, like the gas centrifuge, which made proliferation seem like it was going to be easier than was previously believed, also kind of easier to hide than was previously believed. So you had kind of a fertile environment for proliferation. And then China tests a nuclear weapon in 1964, kind of adding on to all of those factors I just mentioned. And that led certainly American policymakers and kind of lots of people around the world to worry. You'd basically see like the nuclear floodgates opening at this point. There's a bunch of different reasons why that was considered plausible, right? Not just those background factors I mentioned, but kind of the specifics of China and its neighborhood, right? So you had a lot of countries in China's region that didn't have nuclear weapons and might be threatened by a Chinese nuclear arsenal, right? Taiwan's the most obvious example, but you also had Japan, South Korea, India, Australia. And these are all countries that might have felt they needed to respond to China. And so maybe it's kind of reasonable to conclude you'd see more proliferation in that region. So that's one part of it. But then there's also just, what kind of country China was at the time, right? And how it was perceived by the United States. China's getting nuclear weapons pretty much showed for the first time that even quite impoverished countries could develop nuclear weapons, right? Countries that did not have like a high degree of technological sophistication. And so that kind of changed the way policymakers were thinking about this too, right? It didn't seem like proliferation was just going to be a thing that like rich Western countries did anymore, right? It could be something that, developing countries could master as well. So I think that was kind of the overall kind of logic behind why people were worried about cascades in the 1960s. Then you see, pretty similar dynamics play out a decade later when India tests its first nuclear device in 1974. So part of it is kind of reinforcing the message about developing countries being able to do this. Right? India also, relatively poor country at the time. But the kind of unique factor in the India case is demonstrating the severity of, what people call the dual use problem, right? Because India had used technology that, foreign countries like the US and Canada had provided, ostensibly for peaceful purposes, but then they kind of repurposed that technology to produce plutonium for a nuclear explosive, right? And so there's this concern that a new kind of proliferation pathway had been opened, right, by India, and lots of other countries were going to follow down that road. I think I would argue that those panics in the 60s and 70s were a lot more understandable actually than what we're seeing now. One reason for that is just kind of what the proliferation landscape looked like then compared to now, right? So if you get in a time machine and you go back to the 60s or the 70s, there were actually a lot of countries that were known to be trying to get nuclear weapons or were like very seriously considering it. It's not a short list. I mean, Israel, West Germany was thinking about it, Pakistan, Brazil, Argentina, South Korea, Taiwan, Iran, Sweden, right? Not a country that in the modern era we think about associated with nuclear weapons. And that's just like a partial list. So given all of this interest in nuclear weapons, I think it was actually pretty plausible to think you might see a bunch of new countries getting nuclear weapons quickly, right? But if you contrast that to today, it's a totally different environment. There's actually no country in the world right now that's known to be actively seeking nuclear weapons. And I think that might be like the first time ever in the nuclear age that we've had that, right? People will debate about Iran, right? Are they trying to get nuclear weapons or not? If you look at just what the US intelligence community says in their public releases, they say Iran hasn't made the decision yet. And so if you buy into that, we don't have any countries that are known to be trying to get nuclear weapons that don't already have them, right? There might be a couple countries that are considering it, right? And we already talked about Saudi Arabia and South Korea, right? But that's a much shorter list than what we were talking about in the 60s and 70s. So it's hard to imagine like what this cascade would even look like, right? Like what countries are we even talking about here that would get you to something that you could call a cascade? The other thing I would say is in the 60s and 70s, these sort of panics also made more sense because the non-proliferation regime was just much weaker than it is today, right? The obstacles to proliferation were so much lower, right? So we didn't even get the NPT until 1968, right? And that came about in part because the US and the Soviets wanted to prevent these sort of proliferation cascades. But even after that, even after the NPT entered into force in 1970, if you actually go back and kind of look at the list of countries that were, members who had ratified the treaty, initially, at least, like pretty much all of the countries or the majority of countries that were, countries of concern when it comes to proliferation were not actually members. They hadn't ratified. And it took a lot of them a long time to join, or some of them just, stayed out, period. So there was not a particularly strong level of adherence to the NPT, not very strong limitations on nuclear trade. And there's really no enforcement mechanism in the NPT, and there wasn't really kind of an established, operating procedure for what you do if a country violates it. And all that stuff ultimately gets addressed to some degree, actually in the aftermath of India's test in 1974. So you have the US making this big push to actually get, important sort of threshold states to ratify the treaty, right? So countries like West Germany and Japan that had been dragging their feet ultimately ratify. You have the nuclear suppliers group being formed around the same time to set kind of stricter standards for nuclear trade. And then you also get sanctions starting to be threatened and used at a much higher rate by the United States. And countries that were trying to develop nuclear weapons in this time often faced pretty intense pressure from the US to stop those programs. Again, South Korea, Taiwan are interesting examples there. And today, we benefit from, a strong NPT, a nuclear suppliers group, decades long kind of enforcement track record. And so that means there's just much, much higher hurdles today, right, to any country really trying to acquire nuclear weapons. And so that means, these arguments about cascades just aren't as compelling as the ones that were made in these earlier eras, I think.
Wow, thanks, Nick, for providing that very rich historical context to the proliferation panic today. I want to zone in a little deeper now on factors that constrain or slow proliferation. You had a piece out in Foreign Policy, I believe in October, where you look at some of those factors, which one might group into external factors. So external factors that constrain would-be proliferators, whether it's the NPT that you already mentioned, sanctions, export controls, or the military threat by another state. And then perhaps internal factors that inhibit the pursuit of proliferation, whether that's economic costs or domestic political factors, perhaps normative considerations, or the conscious choice by a state to rely on a nuclear-armed ally for extended deterrence. Now, given all the work that you have done on proliferation historically, I'm wondering whether we can at all say that there's some sort of hierarchy or relative weight to these factors, whether their relative weight has shifted over time. You sort of talked about the 60s and 70s a little while ago, or is this really entirely a context and country dependent story?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's hard to figure that out, at least, in a systematic, reliable way that, we as social scientists are trying to achieve. Right. And I think in large part that's because nuclear proliferation is so rare, right? Which, at least in my opinion, is a good thing, right? But it poses limitations when you're trying to study this kind of in a robust way, right? We only have 10 countries that have ever gotten nuclear weapons. Depending on how you define it, maybe there's 20 or 30 countries that have tried to get them or have kind of taken steps in that direction. And so when we're trying to figure out like the determinants of proliferation, we just don't have a lot of data to work with. That hasn't stopped scholars from trying to study this stuff, statistically, right? So there's been dozens of studies by political scientists that are kind of trying to tease out the impact of all these different factors that you mentioned. But I think what ends up happening is because of the rarity of proliferation, the findings of these studies tend to be very fragile and sensitive. They depend on, very small choices like, what exactly are the variables you included in your model? How did you measure these different concepts? Which statistical technique did you use? How did you code individual cases, right? Like, did this country try to get nuclear weapons or not? Scholars disagree about that in particular cases. So we end up having very different results in these studies sometimes just based on minor choices. And so I think that means we can't have a ton of confidence, right, in what those studies are telling us. My own kind of hunch, just from studying a lot of these cases and studying, you know, the history of proliferation, is that kind of as you hinted at in your question, there's not really a stable hierarchy of importance. And I think constraints in particular, external constraints, have changed in importance over time in a big way. You know, sort of what I was talking about before, but in terms of how the 60s looked so much different than the nuclear landscape today, right? I really don't think it's until the late 1970s that you had kind of a robust non-proliferation regime. And so external constraints, you know, were relevant before that, but I think they loom just so much larger now. And so that means the kind of determinants of proliferation look different today. One interesting pattern my own research has uncovered is if you look at, you know, the countries that were proliferators before there was a strong non-proliferation regime, they actually tended to be, or frequently were, you know, U.S. partners or U.S. allies, right? So think about Britain and France, Israel, Pakistan, South Korea, Taiwan. These are all countries that started their nuclear weapons programs before you had a robust non-proliferation regime. You have that set of countries in the earlier era. If you look at the countries that have been proliferators, once there is this strong non-proliferation regime in place, they look very different, right? So almost exclusively, they're countries that are more or less kind of outside the U.S., you know, sphere of influence, if you want to think about it that way, right? The countries that, you know, American policymakers would often refer to as rogue states, you know, Iran, North Korea, Iraq, Syria. And so to me, that's actually evidence of the external constraints working in action, right? So the countries that are sort of most sensitive to U.S. pressure, right, that are most dependent on the United States, have basically stopped proliferating, right, at least in this like 40-year time span. And I think that's because they kind of understood, once there was a strong non-proliferation regime in place, that a nuclear weapons program risked basically losing U.S. support, right, in a way that it didn't really risk that nearly as much in the 1950s or so, right? And so what ends up happening is the countries that end up being the proliferators that remain are the ones who aren't as sensitive to U.S. pressure because they don't really rely on the U.S. nearly as much. And so to me, that shows like the nuclear landscape shifting over time, right? And these external constraints becoming more important. I guess kind of the corollary of that would be, in the earlier, you know, part of the nuclear age, internal factors probably were more important relatively, just because the external factors played less of a role, right? The prospect of sanctions, I think, or diplomatic isolation was not nearly as salient, right? It really wasn't clear, like, what was going to happen to countries that proliferated. There wasn't a playbook for how you respond to that. And so I think that probably left more room for domestic political factors, right, in decision-making, or just kind of pure security calculations to dominate, right? If you had a very severe external threat, you were going to get nuclear weapons. You're going to try to do it, right? Whereas today, even if you face very strong external threats, you're not necessarily going to do that, right? Because you worry about all the costs you're going to face in the process and the possibility that you're not even going to succeed at getting the bomb because of all of these non-proliferation efforts. I think it's also probably true that earlier on, supply side factors were more important, right? So countries' kind of native industrial capacity or technological capacity was probably more important, and their ability to access nuclear technology from abroad was maybe more important. I think in recent decades, that's probably not as influential, just because the technological hurdles aren't as great, right? People understand nuclear technology better now. Knowledge has diffused, right? There's different proliferation technologies that are easier. We mentioned the gas centrifuge earlier. And so I think that means that, you know, the kind of technological prerequisites are much lower today than they used to be. And I think there's actually some interesting research by a professor named Jeffrey Kaplow that shows this quantitatively. Actually, if you look at kind of the 50s and 60s, the supply side stuff seemed to matter a lot, and it doesn't seem to matter nearly as much, if at all, anymore.
Nick, this is so interesting. We've been talking here about sort of internal drivers, external drivers, the way that they influence proliferation. And so I want to ask you about one of these specifically that we haven't touched upon, which is arms control. You know, I think we can all agree probably that the arms control architecture was not in terrific shape prior to February of 2022, but certainly since Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the attendant, you know, confrontation and tension that has emerged between Russia and the West has made things look quite a bit worse, I would say. And most recently, for those who are following the news, you know, Russia has refused to meet under the Bilateral Consultative Commission, and which is part of the New START Treaty. And that has led the United States for the first time to accuse Russia of not abiding by the terms of that agreement. And with this, we've seen, you know, commentators, observers, analysts suggest that there could now be this very real possibility that we will enter into an environment, whether that's in 2026 when New START expires, or potentially even before that, when we're not going to have any more legally binding strategic arms control agreements between the two largest nuclear weapon states. So, you know, recognizing again, of course, that this is quite speculative, if this were to come to pass, what does your research suggest about what the implications would then be for proliferation or non-proliferation, if there indeed would be any implications?
Yeah, it's an important question. I think it's a tough question too. I think there definitely would be implications from, you know, the demise of arms control, especially if we assume that's followed by basically a new nuclear arms race, right? That's not necessarily the case, but if it were to come to pass, right, that Russia and the US started, you know, expanding the sizes of their arsenals again, like they did during the Cold War, I think that could have important effects, but I don't think it would be at all straightforward what those effects would be. So, I mean, one thing that it could do is contribute to a narrative that nuclear weapons, you know, are salient, right? Nuclear weapons are back, right? Like they were in the Cold War. I mean, we already were kind of moving towards that anyway, right? In terms of almost every nuclear armed state modernizing their arsenal, if not expanding it. And certainly the war in Ukraine in and of itself has put nuclear weapons back on the agenda in a big way. So it would kind of contribute to that kind of emerging narrative of nuclear weapons kind of returning to salience in international politics. And so you could argue countries might look at that and say, you know, if countries are investing so much money in this and they're building up their arsenals, they must be really important weapons for your security. So maybe I should be thinking about that too. I don't think that on its own, though, is really going to be like a major impetus for proliferation, right? Because of everything we've already talked about, which is these external constraints, right, that I believe will still, in most cases, act as powerful inhibitors, right? You might think nuclear weapons are, you know, really powerful and important, but the path to getting them is just too risky and too costly. And so you're going to find some alternative way of securing yourself, right? Whether that's through an ally or, you know, other types of WMD or conventional technologies that aren't nearly as politically risky to invest in. So there's the kind of that element of it, the salience. I think, you know, other people might say if the US and Russia were building up their arsenals again, that would just strengthen all of these charges of hypocrisy, right, that are often leveled at the P5, I guess, the nuclear armed states that are kind of legitimized by the NPT, right? That basically what the nuclear powers do is they push non-proliferation on others while they build up their own nuclear arsenals. And obviously that's not a great look, right? It seems on its face to be hypocritical. But again, to kind of push back against these narratives, we saw during the Cold War that the non-proliferation regime can certainly survive. One might even argue thrive, right? And or be strengthened in the face of all of these charges of hypocrisy, right? Like the fact that the Soviets and the US built up like 50,000 nuclear weapons apiece didn't lead the non-proliferation regime to collapse, right? And in fact, over time, as we've talked about, the non-proliferation regime was getting stronger, right? And so I think like it provides political arguments that countries can and will employ to criticize the US and Russia. I mean, maybe would just strengthen support for, you know, the TPNW, right, in some quarters. But I don't think like in and of itself that leads to a collapse in the non-proliferation regime or kind of in and of itself lead states to decide they're going to get their own nuclear weapons. I think if you look at, you know, more concrete cases where, you know, this could matter in terms of proliferation, I mean, one obvious place to look is NATO, right? And if Russia is, you know, engaged in some sort of nuclear buildup, naturally, you know, the members of NATO, particularly in Eastern Europe, are going to feel threatened by that. right? In the same way, you know, they felt threatened by Soviet nuclear advances during the Cold War, NATO members did. I think their response would be not to try to get their own nuclear weapons, right? The response would be to go to Washington and say, hey, we need greater commitments from you, right? And you need to reassure us that you have our back, and that you're going to kind of, you know, ensure that Russia doesn't get some sort of advantage by, you know, building up their nuclear arsenal. And to go back to something that I said, you know, towards the outset, I think one could actually even argue that if the US responded to a Russian nuclear buildup by, you know, strengthening its security commitments, maybe expanding or enhancing its own nuclear arsenal in response, that could actually have the effect of strengthening extended deterrence, right? Or strengthening perceptions of kind of the reliability of the US in at least some NATO countries, right? And that could actually make them less likely to seek their own nuclear weapons. I think even if you go outside of NATO, like if you look to East Asia, you could see a similar dynamic at play, right? Japan and South Korea, obviously very worried about North Korean nuclear weapons. Also China, which as we know is engaged in its own nuclear buildup now. Those countries have often been sort of wary about the US shrinking its nuclear arsenal, or, you know, every time we have a nuclear posture review, and at least when there's a Democratic administration, right, and people talk about, hey, should the US, you know, downgrade the role of nuclear weapons or adopt a no first use policy or something like that, or eliminate certain weapons platforms from our arsenal. Often in Japan, people get a little wary, right? Or in South Korea, people get a little worried about it, and they're concerned that the US extended deterrence commitment isn't as credible. Those concerns could be assuaged, right? If there actually was, you know, the US investing in its nuclear arsenal in a big way again. So I think in the non-proliferation realm, you could even argue it would make new nuclear states less likely. That's not to say that a nuclear arms race would be good, right? It would obviously entail a lot of costs, and it could be very dangerous in terms of the bilateral relationship between the US and Russia, and just kind of contribute to this spiral of geopolitical hostility. But I guess my takeaway would be the main kind of dangers and costs aren't really in the non-proliferation realm. It's more about kind of the kind of main geopolitical competition that's going on between the great powers.
Nick, before we go on, I have, you know, that's really interesting. And I agree with you. I think that, that, you know, there isn't necessarily this, the intuitive relationship that we think there is between sort of the demise of the arms control regime and sort of what will happen on the proliferation side of things. But it strikes me that in this conversation and you know, in your work, you know, you're focusing on the state. Within government, of course, there are different actors with different parochial interests. A lot of the work that Hannah and I have done, sort of looking at military innovation, looks at the role of individual institutional advocates for different kinds of capabilities and things like that. And so I wonder if you see any difference, you know, when, if you look at that kind of first image, you know, idea of sort of individuals and how they make decisions and the role of institutional advocates in advocating for different kinds of technologies, whether that would change your answer at all, or whether you still think those patterns that you've teased out apply.
Do you mean specifically in the context of the kind of the demise of arms control, or just kind of more generally?
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, I was in particular thinking about, you know, the comment that you made, which I think is, you know, really compelling here, that there, you know, the demise of arms control could feed into this idea of kind of hypocrisy on the part of the P5 saying, you guys have to play by these rules, whereas we get to do X, Y, and Z thing. So just kind of thinking about the way that that could potentially influence or empower institutional advocates for nuclear weapons, for example, within states who already are interested in developing those kinds of capabilities, kind of lend fuel to the fire, I suppose.
Yes, I definitely think that's possible. I mean, you know, my answer to your question, I was kind of talking about sort of in general, like what I think the tendencies would be, but certainly there's differences across cases. And I think it's possible, like you say, that, you know, in particular countries where maybe there's already, you're kind of pushing on an open door, right? There's like more of an active consideration or debate about nuclear weapons already. This could provide ammunition, right, for people, bureaucratic advocates of nuclear weapons, to push their case, and maybe they help them make a more compelling argument. So I wouldn't rule out that possibility, right? It brings us back to this question that I always like to ask when we're having these discussions, because they can sometimes get really abstract, right? When we're talking about proliferation cascades, like which countries are we actually talking about here? Like what are the countries that are going to see a demise of US-Russia arms control that were maybe already considering nuclear weapons are going to say like now there's going to be some actor within that state who says, I'm going to use this to like decisively win the debate and, you know, start a nuclear weapons program. I'm just not sure what those countries are exactly. Like we mentioned before, if we're talking about countries that are sort of like teetering on this threshold, like maybe they're going to do it, maybe they're not. It's really, you know, Iran's obvious, the obvious case, right? And like, is the debate in Iran going to be swayed by whether the United States builds up its arsenal or not? Like, I don't, I mean, it could play a role, but I doubt it, right? It's like the overriding fact between the US and Iran geopolitically is just, you know, this decades long track record of hostility and like the massive asymmetry of power favoring the US, right? And the fact that the US has like, you know, 6,000 nuclear weapons versus zero to Iran doesn't make a whole lot of difference whether that's 7,000 to zero. And so I don't see it playing a big role in like a case like that. And then, you know, other potential, you know, candidates we've talked about a little bit are like Saudi Arabia and South Korea. And I struggle to see like exactly how, you know, the demise of arms control ends up being kind of a decisive factor in those cases. But I, like I said, I don't kind of rule out the possibility that, you know, people are going to be using this in domestic debates. I think you're totally right about that. And there could be new countries, right, that we're not talking about now, like 5 or 10 years down the line, right, that we didn't think were proliferation candidates in 2023, but are going to be in 2028. And maybe in those cases, this does end up being more important.
Thanks, Nick. I do want to ask you a question specifically about Russia, because you mentioned a few minutes ago that the non-proliferation regime was surviving, if not thriving, during the Cold War, even in the face of a nuclear arms race between the major powers. And I suppose part of the reason why that was is that there was a US-Soviet convergence in wanting to see the non-proliferation regime do well. Mm-hmm. And there are people now who worry that that might be changing in this new era of heightened confrontation with Russia, and that Russia might not only stop compartmentalizing cooperation with Western counterparts on non-proliferation. You already mentioned Russia throwing a wrench into the Iran JCPOA talks after the invasion. But some even go further and ask, could Russia even support proliferation, whether overtly or covertly? Could its nuclear industry play a role there? You wrote a piece not so long ago with Tristan Volpe called The Rise of the Autocratic Nuclear Marketplace, in which you examine, among other things, the evolution of the Russian nuclear enterprise over the last two decades. So I want to ask you a little bit about that. Are you worried that we might see Russia enabling proliferation? Are there any indications to date that that is something to worry about? And sort of more broadly, what does the rise of the autocratic nuclear marketplace portend for the future of proliferation?
Yeah, I think actually over the long run, this is probably the biggest threat to the non-proliferation regime that could come out of the war in Ukraine. Again, it's interesting because that's not what the public discourse around proliferation threats focuses on. Or the sort of a theme of this conversation is the things that like the prominent commentators are saying about proliferation cascades aren't so compelling, but there might be some other ways that the war in Ukraine does affect proliferation, right? We talked about Iran being an example. I think this is another important way that the non-proliferation regime could be harmed. I mean, if you go back to the Cold War, there is evidence that, you know, when bilateral tensions between the superpowers were especially high, they sort of downgraded the importance that they attached to non-proliferation. And obviously that could have lessons for today, right? So in the 1950s and 60s, the US more or less just stood aside as France and Britain got nuclear weapons, right? They didn't, you know, actively help them, but they didn't really try to stop them very hard either. I mean, they tried to kind of convince them or persuade them, but they didn't like turn the screws, right? Or put pressure on them because they viewed like the Cold War competition with the Soviets as of, you know, overriding importance, and they didn't want to damage their alliance relationships for the sake of non-proliferation in that time period. And you see a similar thing with the Soviet Union, right? Where they actually, initially at least, actively helped China in its nuclear weapons program. They then regret that decision and kind of pull the support back. But you see the same pattern, right, in both countries, where when you have like especially high bilateral tensions, the focus on non-proliferation goes down a little bit. And a lot of people would argue the only reason you got the NPT was because you had kind of emerging detente, right? And after the Cuban Missile Crisis and kind of the Germany-Berlin question is sort of more or less settled, then that kind of opens up more space to cooperate. And if you look later in the Cold War, you see kind of echoes of this. In the 80s, the US, you know, had been sanctioning Pakistan, or in the 70s, the US had been sanctioning Pakistan for its nuclear weapons program. Then the Soviets invade Afghanistan in 1979, and those sanctions all get lifted because we're in a new Cold War, right? And the US is focused on getting the Soviets out of Afghanistan, and Pakistan is a crucial partner in that effort. And so that's another example where when you have like really high bilateral tensions, maybe non-proliferation goes onto the back burner. And so we, you know, we could think about how that might play out today and going forward with Russia. Russia and then, you know, formerly the Soviet Union, they do have a long legacy of caring about non-proliferation, right, and taking it pretty seriously. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, would they be willing to make exceptions in this new geopolitical environment? Right, like the same way the US made exceptions for Pakistan in the 1980s. And I definitely think that is possible. I mean, again, you can go back to the case of Iran and think about how this could play out. Iran's enriching to 60% right now, which is, you know, very close, like technically speaking, to weapons grade uranium. What would they do, right, if Iran started enriching to 90%, right, or something close to that, right? Would they really, in this geopolitical environment, pressure Iran not to do that? Right. I have my doubts, right, because of what's going on in Ukraine, right? They might view Iran as actually a pretty important ally when they don't have many allies at all, right? That's supplying them with military technology and is one of the few countries that's kind of willing to support them. I don't know if they'd be willing to risk that relationship, right, to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons in the way that they might have been willing to do that in like 2010 or 2015. And if you think about it, like even more cynically, it's possible that some people in Russia or some decision makers in Russia might think that a nuclear Iran wouldn't even be the worst thing in the world, right? In the current geopolitical environment, maybe it would force the US to commit more resources to the Middle East and less resources to Europe or something like that. Certainly complicate the US's geopolitical environment in general. So that's definitely a risk, I think. It's also possible they'd be willing to supply nuclear technology on looser terms than the US is. Again, in part because of the geopolitical situation where they're trying to maintain some allies and partners, right, in the face of all this international pressure, trying to maybe find some countries they can peel away from the Western orbit or from the US. Right? Saudi Arabia is an interesting case there, potentially. Right? The Russian nuclear industry is, you know, they're one of the candidates, right, for building Saudi Arabia's first nuclear power plants, right? And one wonders like what Putin and Russia are thinking about, what their relationship with Saudi Arabia could look like over the long run. And maybe they'd be willing to be a little bit laxer on the nuclear front if they could get some other kind of geopolitical benefit out of it. So that's all, you know, on kind of sort of on the concerning side. You know, if there's one sort of optimistic thing I could say about Russia and their nuclear industry, which you mentioned, it's definitely true that their nuclear industry is not going anywhere, right? As you hinted at, they're just too important of a player in the marketplace. They have advantages that the United States and others can't really offer in terms of like financing their nuclear deals. But I do think like some countries are going to rethink nuclear trade with Russia, right, going forward as a result of the invasion. And you've already seen some evidence of that. Countries like, you know, Ukraine, Sweden, Finland are all kind of thinking about different choices to reduce their dependence on Russian nuclear fuel, or maybe not be, you know, relying on Russian nuclear technology going forward. So I think at least on the margins, like the Russian nuclear industry is going to be diminished somewhat by this, but it's not going away. I think the other big wild card here in terms of the, you know, the autocratic nuclear marketplace, as we called it, is obviously China, which is also trying to gain a foothold in this area and trying to develop its nuclear industry and kind of get into the export game, right? And they haven't made a ton of progress on that front, at least in terms of like power plants yet, but they're working on it. And that's potentially concerning too, because compared to Russia and the US, they have a very sort of spotty non-proliferation track record. So they proactively helped Pakistan get nuclear weapons. And they're kind of all in on the Pakistani nuclear weapons program. And you know, they gave them a nuclear bomb design. It's not something you commonly see nuclear powers do. They helped them with their enrichment technology. They provided them with HEU, if you believe some of the stories that are circulating. And they've also exported what many would consider to be sensitive nuclear technology to other countries too, Iran, Algeria. And if you think about kind of their general posture towards, you know, non-proliferation pressures that have been directed at Iran and North Korea, often but not always, they're kind of in this situation where they're trying to deflect these pressures, right? And maybe they go along with it, but sort of in a half-hearted way, right? Or maybe they sign on to a new sanctions resolution on North Korea at the UN, but then they don't actually enforce it, right? And so they often act in this sort of they almost act as a protector for these countries to some degree as they're advancing their nuclear programs. And so that's another concern is like, what does China do going forward? It's possible that they could become more serious about non-proliferation as they become more powerful, right? And that's one way that IR scholars think about this, right? Is the more powerful you are, the more you have to lose from proliferation. And so you're going to take it more seriously. But it's also possible that you see a similar dynamic play out as we were talking about with us and Russia, right? Like as bad as US-Russia tensions are right now, US-China tensions are also at a really high level, right? Don't have to talk about the balloons, but we're at the tensest geopolitical moment between these countries, I don't know, since the 1960s. So that's, you know, another potential concern, right? They might calculate that, again, in particular cases, maybe they're going to put non-proliferation on the back burner if it's a way to maintain or build important relationships or to kind of stick a finger in the eye of the United States, right? And again, that could be a country like Iran or Saudi Arabia, right, where they're willing to sort of look the other way.
Well, I'm glad we didn't get to the end of this conversation without talking about the balloon. So thanks for that, Nick. But I want to sort of, I guess, pull on a thread that I think has gone throughout our conversation so far, which is this idea of, you know, nuclear learning. What lessons learned are there for various actors as we look at the conflict today? You co-authored what I thought was an excellent chapter with Mark Bell in a new edited volume that just came out, which is called The Fragile Balance of Terror, Deterrence in the New Nuclear Age. And in this chapter, you take, you know, I would say a critical look at this idea of nuclear learning or the assumption that, you know, states are basically going to over time reach the conclusion that nuclear weapons are good for deterrence, but that they're not really good for much else. And what you and Mark Bell show by looking at, you know, two different cases, you've got, you know, the US and the USSR on one hand, and then India and Pakistan on the other hand, is that nuclear learning turns out actually to be kind of a rare occurrence. And when it does happen, the lessons learned, so to speak, are not always, you know, the right ones, if you will, from the perspective of nuclear or proliferation optimists. So I guess if I can kind of ask you, again, recognizing this is all very speculative because we're sort of in the midst of things as they're unfolding. But, you know, if you apply your findings to what we're seeing in the war in Ukraine, could you give us a sense for the kinds of quote unquote lessons learned or not learned that we could expect policymakers in, you know, I don't know, Moscow, Kyiv, Washington, you know, pick your NATO capital, any others you want to address that they might take from that nuclear crisis or won't they be any at all?
Yeah, I think this is inherently hard to predict, in part because one of the points that we make in that chapter is different observers, even in the same country, right, can draw different lessons from the same events. And I think it's important to point out, like, it often is actually ambiguous what role nuclear weapons play in a given crisis or a given conflict. Scholars, like, literally spend decades debating this in individuals, right? We still don't know or agree, I guess, on what role the atomic bombings play in ending the war in the Pacific in 1945, right? Some people say that was a big part of it, or maybe the most important factor. other people say, no, it was the Soviet Union's entry into the war against Japan. And so really, what, like 70 years later, we still don't agree about that. So we don't know if nuclear weapons coerced Japanese surrender. We don't know, or we don't agree on whether nuclear threats helped end the Korean War. Some people think they do. Some people think they didn't. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, right, you have people that say the nuclear balance mattered a lot, right? And like the fact that the US had a big advantage over the Soviet Union in that time period actually made Khrushchev behave rather cautiously. Other people say, no, it didn't matter. Like the US and the Soviets were kind of equally freaked out, even though the US had far greater capabilities at that time. Abel Archer in the 1980s, same thing. Like we still debate back and forth. Was that dangerous? Was it not? We don't know. Right. And so there's just a lot of like ambiguity, and it's hard to tease out like the role that nuclear weapons play in events, international events and conflicts and crises. And I think that lends itself to people drawing tons of different lessons, right? Because it depends on what they believe happened in these past events, which can just widely differ. That said, we can at least like speculate on what some of the lessons certain actors are going to draw from the conflict in Ukraine, or that they might draw from the conflict. If you start by just thinking about it from Russia's perspective, you can imagine sort of different lessons that could be drawn, right? One lesson could be that Russia's nuclear arsenal ended up being kind of a net negative for Russia because it gave them the sort of security and confidence they needed to walk into what has turned out to be a massive quagmire, right? And has also demonstrated to the world that basically their military was a paper tiger, right? At least compared to the way that a lot of people thought their capabilities would play out, right? And so if they hadn't had nuclear weapons, they probably wouldn't have made as rash of a decision as invading Ukraine. So in that sense, like it facilitated some irresponsible behavior that ended up exposing a lot of their weaknesses to the world, right? That's one way you could look at it. I doubt that's the way that they're going to look at it in Moscow, but that's the way some people, maybe some critics of the regime might look at it. The way it's probably more likely to be interpreted by Putin and his advisors and military officials is, hey, look, Russia's nuclear arsenal actually does succeed at its main mission of deterring NATO intervention, right? Like as much as the US and NATO is willing to support Ukraine, they're not putting boots on the ground, right? They didn't establish a no-fly zone, or at least none of this has happened yet. And I mean, if you look at the things Biden has said, like he's more or less explicit about it, that it's because he doesn't want to have a nuclear war. And so that's pretty compelling evidence for Russia that their nuclear arsenal is having this effect of giving them kind of the space to invade Ukraine without getting a direct NATO response, right? And so one lesson that Russian decision makers might draw from the war is, we were right about our nuclear weapons being a really effective deterrent. It's just that our strategy for fighting Ukraine wasn't as smart as it should have been. And next time around, we'll be smarter about it, but we'll still have this nuclear shield that will allow us to kind of keep the West out of the war. So I think that's one possible lesson. If you think about it from the Western perspective, in the US or NATO countries, they might conclude that extended nuclear deterrence works, right? At least if we assume like the war continues without direct attacks against NATO members. They might also learn, or kind of relearn, I guess, a lesson from the Cold War, right? Which is, you know, this sort of nuclear balance between the US and Russia, and kind of the unwillingness of either side to directly confront each other actually gives you a lot of space to do things at lower levels, right? And the US and NATO it seems like they can do almost anything they want, right, to help kill Russians, right? As long as they don't physically like deploy NATO troops there, or physically put NATO air power into Ukraine, right? And again, as you mentioned, like this is all speculative. We're testing this proposition basically in real time, right? As NATO and US is kind of gradually expanding the scope of its assistance, right? And we won't provide this weapons technology today, but we're going to a month from now, and it just keeps kind of coming, trickling out. And if it and the war ends, right, with, you know, Russia not using nuclear weapons, right, or Ukraine succeeding or at least repelling a lot of Russian advances, that could be a big lesson drawn, right, is we relearned how to fight these sort of proxy conflicts, right, and we learned that we can actually do quite a bit as long as we're not kind of directly getting involved. Ukraine, I mean, what are the lessons they're going to learn? There's obvious lessons about the importance of building and maintaining strong ties to the West, right? And they're probably going to want to be in NATO even more than they did before the war. You know, one thing a lot of people talk about here is, you know, Ukraine's decision to give up the nuclear weapons that was on its, were on its territory when the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, it's easy to say that a lot of people in Ukraine maybe regret that decision, right? And maybe that is the case, although, you know, as you know, many people know, like they didn't actually have operational control over those weapons. So it's not as simplistic as it's often portrayed. So there could be regret about that, but I don't think that means, you know, Zelensky or any successor is going to say, okay, let's get nuclear weapons, right? Because that's basically directly in tension with the other objective of building strong ties with the West, right? You're not going to have a strong relationship with the US and NATO if you're building nuclear weapons, right? And that's basically the reason why they gave up the weapons that were on their territory back in the 1990s, right? As they knew they were only going to have kind of strong ties with the West if they made that decision. So I think the nuclear angle in Ukraine is complicated by that. You know, it's important to have a general caveat in all this conversation, which is a lot of this could depend on, you know, how the war evolves, right, and how it ends, right? And that could play a big role in what lessons are learned. So it's more plausible Russia is going to continue to view nuclear weapons as kind of these facilitators of aggression if they actually succeed, right, at holding big chunks of Ukrainian territory, I would think. And it's more plausible, I think, that the US and NATO learn that nuclear weapons kind of give them all this space to massively support Russia's enemies. If the war ends like without Russia using nuclear weapons against Ukraine, right? If we get to the point, for example, where Western support gets to such a high level that Ukraine is, I don't know, like working to take back Crimea or something like that, and Russia uses a nuclear weapon, that might lead to very different sorts of lessons, right? And maybe in the US and NATO, they say, hey, actually, maybe we overdid things a little bit and there were some thresholds we shouldn't have crossed. So we should definitely be open to the possibility that these lessons are going to change as a result of the conclusion of the conflict. One last thing I'll just say is you could imagine a pretty dangerous lesson that Russia might learn from this, especially if the war ends, you know, in more or less a defeat for them, right? They don't succeed at gaining significant portions of territory, or at least they conclude it was kind of a Pyrrhic victory. Maybe they decide the problem was our nuclear strategy wasn't aggressive enough. Right? This gets to the point that we make in the chapter, right? Sometimes you would assume like if you face this really dangerous nuclear crisis, you step back from the brink and say, oh, we should kind of be more cautious going forward. Sometimes states do the exact opposite and say, no, we just didn't have a good enough nuclear strategy. And like that's kind of a lesson that Pakistan learned from the Kargil War in 1999, even though they were defeated, right? And their strategy didn't work. They said, oh, we just didn't have a credible enough nuclear threat, basically. And Russia might conclude that as well. And maybe they'll say, the problem was like our nuclear threshold wasn't low enough, right? Like we should have been better about like convincing the US and NATO that no, actually, we actually would use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Right. And we would use them even if you're just arming them and you're not getting directly involved in the conflict. And so maybe their nuclear doctrine just becomes even more sort of aggressive going forward. And I think that's possible as well.
That's a pretty interesting last insight there, Nick. We've had a long conversation, so I just want to ask you a quick question at the end, which is somewhat a bit more personal. Part of what we're trying to achieve with Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower is really bridge the gap between scholars and policymakers. And you as a scholar work on issues that are pretty pertinent to policymaking. So we just wanted to ask you what kinds of approaches you found to be useful or effective in terms of, you know, communication, knowledge sharing with policymakers, or what sorts of approaches you would advise against, if you can share something with our listeners.
Yeah, I would start, I think, by saying people like to talk about there being a big gap. That's the term people always use between policymakers and academics. And I think that certainly is like a real thing. But my own sense of it is that has narrowed pretty significantly in recent years, like the last decade or so, for a bunch of reasons. I think in part is due to explicit efforts that we're trying to bridge the gap, right? You know, the Bridging the Gap initiative has worked a lot on this. I think you've also seen, at least this is my kind of intuitive sense, certainly in this administration, a lot of academics going into government in a way that seems unusual compared to certainly the Trump administration, but I think even like previous Democratic administrations. And I also think the way academic research is being conducted in recent years is more conducive to kind of being useful for policymakers, in the sense that, at least in political science, international relations, there's been a movement away from kind of abstract grand theory, right? Like debates between realism and liberalism, constructivism. There's not so much of that anymore. And most of the research that's getting done is, you know, what people talk about is problem-driven research, right? Like you're interested in studying a particular substantive topic or answering a particular question, like when does this particular policy work, right? As opposed to like, is realism or liberalism right? Right. And obviously studies of whether sanctions work or when they work is like more useful to a policymaker than an esoteric article about like, you know, constructivism or something. So I think that all like helps with the gap being bridged. You talked about kind of what the communities could learn from each other. Obviously both communities can learn important things from each other. I think academics, at least in theory, you know, we're meant to be more careful in terms of how we're kind of using evidence, right? We try to be systematic in evaluating claims. We try to be very careful about identifying like when relationships are causal, right? As opposed to kind of just correlations. We try to be really careful about assessing like alternative explanations for whatever phenomena we're observing. And it's not to say that doesn't exist in the government. These are kind of generalizations, right? And a lot of people in the intelligence community sometimes look sort of similar to what academics are doing. But I think on average, right, that's kind of a comparative advantage of academics. And I think those are very important skills that are valuable to policymakers and would be valuable to them, you know, when they're trying to figure out like which policy tool should they be using in a given instance, right? It's helpful there to have like a big knowledge base to work from and say, like, what do we know about how likely this is to work or when it works? And how confident can we be about that actually being a causal relationship that we've identified? Policymakers, obviously, I would have a lot to, you know, teach to academics as well. My sense is that policymakers tend to be more sensitive to like the constraints that are operating on decision makers, like political constraints and geopolitical constraints when they're making policy decisions. And, you know, policy academics will often be like, well, my study showed you that this policy works, so you should do this policy. And policymakers will be like, oh, it's not that simple. There's political difficulties with doing that. That would affect our relationships with all these other countries in 8 different ways. And your study didn't look at any of that, right? So that's, I think policymakers have an advantage in that sense that they're kind of looking at things more holistically. I think policymakers also kind of often value knowledge or kind of insights about specific cases more and less than like general relationships or trends that academics tend to focus on, right? So, I mean, going back to like the sanctions example, like an academic could say, well, we know from these studies, there's only like a 25% success rate of sanctions being imposed, right? But a policymaker might say in response, like, okay, that's useful to know, but what I want to know is what are the odds of success in this case that we're talking about right now and this specific type of sanction, right? And your study didn't look at that. And so I think academics could learn from those sort of perspectives as well, right? And try to think more holistically when you're doing your research, try to understand more like the constraints that are acting on decision makers, like when you're making these sort of policy recommendations. In terms of communication between the two camps, I mean, one kind of obvious point, but it's worth just repeating is, you know, policymakers, generally speaking, are not going to be reading your journal articles as an academic, right? And they're not going to be reading your like 250-page book that has like 700 footnotes. And so if you want them to be aware of kind of the insights that your research has or the findings that you have, you really need to be communicating it in a shorter format in some sort of like public-facing outlet, you know, whether that's something like Foreign Affairs, War on the Rocks, you know, there's a ton of different outlets like this. That's, you know, much more likely to be read, right? It's not only because they're not academics and they're not necessarily going to be scouring the scholarly journals, but they also don't have a ton of time, right, to spend reading books. And they might have time to spend like 10 minutes reading your War on the Rocks article. So that's an obvious point, but I think that's really important. And in my own experience, that is the predominant way that like policymakers have been aware of things that I've done and written, right? It's not that they read my book or my journal articles. Another thing that I've found that has been useful, at least for me, having a presence on Twitter has helped me like make connections with people in the policy community and communicate with them in certain instances. That kind of adds to visibility, right? And makes it more likely people see the stuff that you write. Even if you are publishing in Foreign Affairs or War on the Rocks, people are more likely to read it if it shows up in their feed somehow because someone they know retweeted it or something. We should be clear, there's really big drawbacks to Twitter as well, as anyone who uses it will tell you, especially if you have like any intention of actually trying to have like a good faith debate, that's basically impossible on Twitter, right? And if you wade into some of these policy debates, you're just going to be like mercilessly attacked by trolls, right? But like, I do think it can be useful for getting your work out there, right? And you can use it just to kind of publicize, you know, the articles that you're writing. You don't have to wade into like these sort of political policy debates if you don't want to, obviously. I guess the last thing I would say on this topic is, I think personal relationships are actually pretty important here, right? And those take time to develop, right? So, I mean, if you're like a young academic, right, who just got your PhD or something like that, you shouldn't expect that, like, you know, instantaneously or within even a couple of years that like your work is going to be, you know, widely read in DC and all of that. I think it's something that takes time, right? And policymakers are more likely to care about what you write or read it if they already know you, right? Or if they found your insights useful in the past, right? And that's something that you can't kind of do in the blink of an eye. And so I think the kind of the best thing you can do to develop those relationships is just kind of consistently try to get your work out there in these public facing outlets. And also, you know, to the extent that the opportunities are available to you, kind of take part in the events and workshops that bring these communities together, or like whether it's Bridging the Gap or something else, actually meeting these people face to face and getting to know them, I think can be very, very useful as well, at least in terms of people, you know, taking the time to read what you write.
Oh, that was quite a lot of advice at the end of our conversation, which I think was incredibly rich and useful as we approach the anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We've spoken about historical context to proliferation. We've mused about scenarios going forward. And I think it's just been incredibly interesting and rich. So thank you so much, Nick, for joining us.
Thanks. It was a great conversation.